coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. I am Andrew Farmer. With me, as always, the Jedi Cole Houston.
Good evening, everyone. This is going to be a hell of a ride.
Oh, my God, isn't it? Isn't it? I would implore you to stick around after the podcast and listen to a few snippets from the warm-up. Cole and I, our album comes out in the fall.
That's right.
It's going to be great. But anyway,
we're going to actually be opening for Ultan Cafe.
If you have followed us on Instagram, or if you have listened to the last couple issues, we have kind of dropped a few hints about what's about to transpire. And I don't even know. Okay, so let me start with this caveat. Do not – I can't endorse or condone doing what Cole and I have done in the past week, which is taken 7 to 8 volumes of Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples' epic masterpiece saga and jam it into your brains as if you were a Moloko-ridden Clockwork Orange character.
I'm a drinking man myself.
Trying to process that and trying to process it because it's damn near impossible. And you will be on an emotional roller coaster for 7 days straight.
In fact, before the show, I was talking to Andy, and you were saying, I just consumed 7 volumes of Saga in 7 days. And I'm like, I did 8 volumes in 4.
Yeah, your constitution amazes me.
Because I could not put the damn thing down.
Well, I had to, because here's the thing, is you... So there are great... Saga... God, this is going to be really, really hard. There's going to be a lot of stuttering through this. It's the opposite of the anime issue where there's so much to talk about that we're trying to align and order the thoughts that we want to talk about here. But Saga's not like anything I've read in 30 plus years of comic book reading. Nothing.
Well, then you couple that with the fact that unlike the entire bulk of the I think I'm turning Japanese arc, we've got such a frame of reference that it's frightening.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's insane. So I guess what we're going to try to do today is unpack our favorite moments, our favorite themes, what they do so well. And basically this is just sort of our altar to the greatness that is Saga. I take Saga and I put it in the same category as a Watchman.
Oh, I'm thinking that it's like that scene in, what was it, like one of the Wolverine movies? You know, I thought you were one of a kind.
Yeah.
I was wrong. and that's literally where I am with Saga. It is easily in the top 5 comics that will be on my list to read over and over and over again. Because it's just such a tapestry.
It's woven so uniquely. My problem is that I want to read it once a year. You know, I want it to fall in the same category as Watchmen or Dark Knight Returns or
Kingdom Come or Swamp Marvels.
Thing, Marvels, in that category. But I don't
Starman.
Know. Starman.
For God's sake.
I don't know if I can. And I mean that to be honest. Like, this book had a visceral effect on me. Like, you know, I would piecemeal read, you know, and they were great and I loved them and you know, there's a emotional attachment to these books that you know, Brian K. Vaughan, and so you'll get the joke after this.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, Brian K. Vaughan.
I am biting my tongue off not to repeat that.
I know
you'll catch up. Later.
Listen, a good comedian knows when to leave the stage. And Fiona Staples, just you know, if you look at Brian's other work, and yes, I can call him Brian. We're on a first name basis. You know, we've talked about Ex Machina. We've talked about Why the Last Man. And we will do an entire...
Because we like The Last Man.
We'll do an entire show on Brian K. Vaughan at some point. But he's a masterful writer. You know, in my upper echelons of writers. By the way, speaking of, we need to mention now that upon the recording of this issue, it is the Bill Finger's birthday. So
we need to
head on over
the
renew
BillFingerBang.com.
Yeah, head on over to BillFingerBang.com, which is owned by the Jedi Cole Universe, and visit that website. Eddie Medina Incorporated, TM, registered trademark.
Good Lord.
But he injects just the human experience in every facet and fold into his work, and I think this is his magnum opus. I don't think that it gets... I'm loath to say that it gets better.
I think the best way to describe Saga is, of all the completely effed up comic book universes I've encountered, this was the most human.
No,
because it literally is. It takes you to bizarre ass worlds and impossible situations, and yet never loses its humanity.
No, in fact, the more bizarre, the more effed up it gets, the more human it gets. Just like actual people.
Exactly.
And we talked about during when the first time we brought up Saga on the show was during the first recommended reading that we did. And that was a long time ago in a galaxy.
That was about 9 months ago.
So. It was more than that, man. We'll go back and look, but regardless, the first thing we said about it was that unlike a book that feels the need to create, give you every piece of a backstory before launching you headlong into their story, this one drops you into the hairy middle of the shit and you figure it out.
Yes, you figure it out. You start out. I have equated this to what it seemed like. And it, without me really consciously realizing, but it feels like, in many ways, what, no surprise coming from me, but this is what Star Wars was like.
Yeah.
You were dropped into the hairy middle with a brief narrative.
Yeah.
And you know, it's up to you. It didn't spoon feed. I don't know at what point we decided that people had to have absolutely everything given to them up front in a narrative, that we couldn't just jump in immediately and go nuts. And it's up to you to work out what is this universe.
Yeah.
And the wonderful thing is what Brian K. Vaughan does is, or Brian.
Yeah. If you're me, Brian.
Yeah. If you're Andy, there is enough of the familiar that, you know, absolutely everything isn't so alien that you're watching the goddamn Ewok TV movie. There's enough of the familiar tropes. It's taking the things you know from the real world and dropping them into this weird sci-fi fantasy kind of thing where you have science and sorcery. We haven't had this level of science and sorcery hand in glove since Thundar the Barbarian, for God's sake. And prior to that, we had to get by on wizards from Ralph Bakshi.
I got by on wizards.
Oh, we all did.
Oh, I got by on wizards, my friend. I got by on wizards. No, but and the thing is, the further into you get, the more bizarre it gets. But the more comfortable you feel. It's really weird how well they take you, they create comfort zones in these worlds that you have. And the reason is, it's not the visuals, it's not the conversations, it's thematically comfortable. Regardless, so the whole story, this is going to be the most stupid summary I could possibly imagine for a book like this, but the whole story.
And I think we should point out right off the bat, or as far up the bat as we are right now, that if you have never encountered Saga and you want to go in fresh, you might come back to this one.
Yeah, and we're going to try not to spoil,
there are things that we have to talk about. And in talking about them, we're going to be giving up the family secrets.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. So deal with it. Get off of this podcast. Go read. You can do it in 4 days, apparently, if you're Cole and you have an iron really, emotional constitution. You know,
as they say in Michael Keaton said in Batman, you want to get nuts? Let's get nuts. You'll get nuts in 4 days.
Alcon 2019. You want to get nuts? Let's get nuts. Brand mixed nuts will be making an appearance.
Yeah.
So it unfolds kind of between two worlds. Well, a planet and a planet's moon. The planet is Landfall. The planet's moon is help me out.
Wreath.
Thank you. Reef.
And what I love about these names is that in this brilliant sort of way, you're given a wonderful way to remember their names. Because if you think of the planet being the larger body as Landfall and Reef as an orbiting heavenly body.
Yes.
I'm like, how subtly brilliant.
Oh, the whole book does that, though.
Are these? Yes, exactly. It's so chock full of stuff like that. But please.
So Landfall and Wreath. Landfall are mostly humanoid. They're people with wings, essentially. Yeah,
they're normal folks who just happen to have wings. And apparently, there is absolutely zero continuity.
Right.
In the wings. You get big ass cicada wings, some have bat wings or bird wings, or I mean, you know, just practically every wing. I'm half expecting someone to have the Wright brothers plane wings
at some point.
At this point, like our Steve and I, my atrocious comics character that Steve came up with, I'd come up with our analog to Angel was Kitty Hawk.
That's fantastic.
Who was born with Wright brothers wings.
And they're this is a planet of high technology. So, light based guns, not too many projectile weapons, you know, armor, flying cars, the whole kit and caboodle. Then you flip the script on Wreath. Wreath is populated by what, for lack of a better term, a satyr race, more swords and sorcery. Magic based.
And again, with Wreath, you have this wonderful multiplicity of, you know, the sort of the slang for the two warring parties.
Well, I love
is the wings and the horns.
Mm-hmm.
And the peoples of Wreath have every horn and antler in the catalog. 8 volumes in, I think I have literally seen the comparative anatomy of nearly every ungulate that has any type of protrusion from their skull.
Yes, and these two, for lack of a better term, races have been at war for time untold. Enough time for that war to have spilled away from their planets, leaving their planets at this point, for the most part, peaceful. And spilled out into the universe, into other planets, solar systems, at one point a comet, just everywhere. So the story unfolds on these two worlds at war, two refugees, which we will not, again, you're thrown into the hairy middle of a childbirth. The first issue of this comic.
Yeah. We haven't had this level of childbirth since Miracle Man.
I was going to say, literal childbirth, down to the point where, Marco, the one of the main protagonists in the book, bites through the umbilical cord.
Oh, that's right. He does gnaw the umbilicus.
It's crazy.
Off.
But
thankfully, we're spared any imperative, any sort of instinctual imperative to devour the afterbirth.
Yeah.
for fear of predators. Luckily, there were trash cans or something available.
Well, I think they were interrupted, which we won't get into. But
oh, that's true. Yeah.
So the book...
Who knows where it could have gone.
At this point, we realize that the book is unfolding not in third person, not in the narrative of Marco or, you know, anyone else that we know of right now, but it's being told from the perspective of a flashback from their child.
Yeah, effectively you are seeing the birth of your narrator.
Yes. Yes, you are.
You get to see something your narrator just had to be told about.
Very quickly we find out that, you know, these two are refugees that, of course, we're never supposed to fall in love. We're never supposed to consummate a relationship or have a child because one is Landfallen and one is Wreath.
Exactly, and they've both. You're sort of given enough information to know that they are not only refugees, but they've effectively both defected from everything.
Yep.
Of their home worlds. Marco was a prisoner of war, but he goes running off with the enemy when she deserts.
Conscientious objectors is what they refer to themselves as. So thus begins the adventure. The first part of the adventure, getting off of... And what planet are they on when we find them? I'm trying to remember. Scarf? No, that was Star Wars.
You're thinking of Snarf from Thundercats.
Snarf!
Planet Snarf! I think, what the hell was the name of it? Because it was a contentious planet that was held by Landfall.
Right.
And I am drawing a blank now on that one.
I am too, but... And again, we're not going to go whole hog into explaining every panel of this comic because we would be here forever. But that's where it begins. That's where we start. And from there, thematically, it's insane and beautiful and funny and smart and gut-wrenching. And it almost impossible to sum up into a put in a bag for you to take.
No, you can't, because there, among other things, there's so many worlds. Cleave, that's right, yes. Which, again, a brilliant little nod, because this is the point where they're breaking free, is on Cleave.
Mm-hmm. God, it's such a good book. If you haven't read it, just go read it. Damn it.
But, you know, 8 volumes in, there's probably about 18 to 25 different, probably more than that now that I think about it, distinct races that represent a lot of different planets that have been sucked into this ongoing war. There's no shortage of anthropomorphic animals of various types. And then you got weird ass hybrids, and you've got just bizarre. I think the single most bizarre, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the single most bizarre principal race is the one that the bounty hunter, the freelancer, the Stalk.
The Stalk and the Stalk's brother, which we find out later.
Yes. Dear Lord.
See, for me, there are races...
such a brilliant design, because she has, like, it's like the Venus de Milo got crammed into a spider.
Well, it's very akin to, if anybody's a D&D nerd, it's very akin to what we know as a Drider. But it's great.
Except with no regular arms.
Yeah, no regular arms.
Which, like, her regular arm area ends...
That's true. That's the Venus de Milo part. You're right. You're right.
Yeah, and it's just... And wearing a dress.
For me, it's... And you'll have to help me with the names of the name of the race, but it's the robot people.
Oh, basically, it's the Robot Kingdom.
The Robot Kingdom, yes, yes.
And everybody in the upper echelon of their society are various honorific robot, like Baroness Robot or Viceroy Robot. So apparently, everybody. And it only just now occurred to me how brilliant that is. I don't know if this was intentional, but it almost has to be.
What's that?
What is the one thing historically that occurs in monarchies?
What is...
It's the same thing that occurs in the Appalachians.
Inbreeding?
Yeah, basically, yeah, the family tree doesn't have very many branches.
Right.
And it just occurred to me that maybe that was a subtle way of suggesting that the hierarchy are all inbreeds because they're all fill-in-the-blank honorific robot.
That's nice. Yeah.
Or the 27th or the what have you.
But what's...
But everybody's name is robot, and then you get, when you do meet a commoner, the commoner has a proper name.
What I thought the absolute coolest thing about this race was that they have TVs for heads.
Yes.
So they have what appears to be CRT TVs for heads. And what happens on these, and it's used so fucking brilliantly in so many cases, is inner thoughts are broadcast on the screen. So if something is, if you're trying to convey subtlety, they have a theme in this book, which is while trying to convey subtlety, wearing your intentions on your sleeve. And they do it with the robot kingdom just the same as they do it with Lion Cat, where they're going to show you the inner workings of what's going on these monitors, because the other thing about the robot kingdom is they're very prim, they're very proper, they're very monarchical,
very ostentatious.
Thank you. Ostentatious is a good word. Very austere race. You know, everything is kind of broken down. The main character that we get to see is Prince Robot. Prince Robot is on a mission because the robots, like we said, this war has spilled out into the cosmos. The Landfallen have signed an accord with the Robot Kingdom, which is explained later in the book, I think, quite brilliantly. Prince Robot is sent out to find Marco and why can't I think of her name? Cole, give me.
Oh, Alana.
Thank you, Alana and Hazel, the daughter. And bring them to justice, because this is just no one can let the news of this union out.
Well, they represent, among other things, you have this self-perpetuating war that has spilled over into hundreds and hundreds of worlds, and it's this all-encompassing, all-consuming war that nobody really knows. Nobody has clue, one, what it's all about.
Right,
but
it's happened for so long that no one can.
It has to perpetuate. It's the old, again, speaking of the Appalachians, you got your hillbilly feud going on here writ large. And the one thing you can't have is a suggestion of peaceful relationships peaceful relations between the two parties, much less, God forbid, or God's forbid, depending on who you're asking in this thing. What do you, the impossibility that has been drilled into everyone's head that, if you're on the battlefield and you're raping the enemy, don't worry.
Right.
Our species are patently incompatible.
Right. It could never happen.
This is an impossibility.
So,
not that you would be caught dead raping the enemy, but just in case. When am I ever going to go back to Haiti? Why use a condom?
And also, all of the war criminals that we find, and you don't want to fall for the enemy, because first of all, they're ugly monsters, and second of all, you would not be able to have any kind of lasting relationship with them anyway. But the robots' inner feelings, innermost desires, true intentions are broadcast right across their face. So you get instances where, really well-played instances where Prince Robot discovers he has a child. And it's, and it's played out beautifully across the screen of his face. Or when there's, and again, we're spoiling shit, but when he finally succumbs to the pressure of not being able to find his child and the wars he's been through, and there are PTSD illusions, and he's high on one particular drug that is a through line for the last kind of half of the released books, and he loses his mind, and you know he's trying to hide the thoughts that he's having from people, but they're just broadcast right across the screens, and it's heartbreaking.
Or the point where much much further in, you have an older Hazel and her friend Curty watching his dreams.
Oh my God, that was so brilliant.
And he wakes up and he's like, get out of here! How dare you?
Stop watching my... I told you to stop watching me while I sleep, because his dreams are broadcast across his screen, which is... That never even occurred to me until I read it. I was just like, that's brilliant.
Oh, I know. And then the other thing that's amazing is they're still damned robots.
Yeah.
There are multiple times where, you know, Prince Robot's hanging out and all of a sudden, bing, incoming call. And here's this, you know, the symbol of the royal house of Robot.
A robot, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. A robot thigh. But, you know, the seal of the robot kingdom.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing because all of it. And then on top of all of this, your entree to Prince Robot is him having intercourse with Princess Robot.
Right.
And her, you know, just yelling at him to give it to her hard. And it's like,
what is happening right now?
And then there are things like, you know, Prince Robot having a drink or, and yeah. Like, it's a screen. How does this work? It's, And I think one of the other really brilliant things is, you know, those giant ass security camera housings that look like somebody took a birdhouse and
yes.
stretched it. There's actually one shot where they talk about the planet of the robot kingdom, and you see this peasant on the outskirts of the castle tilling the soil, and there are these robot beasts of burden, and their heads are those kind of damn cameras.
That's amazing.
And I was just like, holy crap, they've thought of everything. And that's the other thing that draws you in, is the fact that there are all of these familiarities turned on their ear.
Well, but that, and they humanize. Because at its root core, you've got, and I'm not even, we're not even getting into it, but you've got a, their babysitter is a horror, they call them the horrors, but she's basically a ghost that is bonded to Hazel, the daughter, that can only come out at night and not during the day. They fly off in a wooden kind of tree-based rocket ship.
Yes, it's a from the rocket ship forest.
From the rocket ship forest.
And in fact, I believe it was Isabel even mentions some of the amenities of that particular year's crop.
Right, yes.
And it's all okay that this ship can...
It's because they make it so human, Cole. Because at its root, at its base, and there are panels that most exquisitely show this, it is a story of family, of loss, of relationships, of keeping something together through the most trying times you can, of war, of the loss and pain of war, of losing children, of losing families, you know, and it plays out that, you know?
Yes. And can we talk a moment about loss? You know, it is said of writers, and in fact, they even mentioned brilliantly, one of the characters is a writer.
It's so good, those two.
And...
Oh, yes.
There's
yes.
even a mention made of the idea of, you know, a writer must be prepared to kill his children effectively, and how this particular writer hated that.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's brilliant about this, a very difficult kind of choice in narratives for me to swallow, is the idea of, okay, let's, you know, from a Star Wars standpoint, you know Anakin Skywalker is going to survive up to a point, and that he's ultimately going to live a lot longer.
As, yes.
Albeit not in the best shape. Because you
better
already
shape.
Know where exactly, you know, you're going back in time. So you know pretty much which characters are going to survive and to what level. You get a similar effect when you have someone like in the Road Warrior, you don't know it's the feral kid who's narrating all this until the end.
Right.
But if you did know, you know the feral kid's going to live. So this is giving you the feral kid if you knew from the outset. See that little punk with the razor boomerang? That was me way back when. So you know unequivocally that Hazel is going to live to tell this tale. And that becomes a very, it's such a chestnut that, you know, I kind of cringe sometimes when that sort of thing
right
is put forth, because it usually doesn't work, but they make it work. And there's so many things they make work. So what do you do when you're in a situation where you know who, at least one character that will never be killed? What do you do? And that is to endear you deeply, even to the bad guys.
Yes. Oh, God, yes.
Like, where it hurts to lose almost anyone, because all of the characters become so deeply developed, oftentimes in a heartbeat, and you feel their loss. I mean, you're stunned when the stalk is killed. Like, what? Wait a minute.
Well, we were talking about that. Where
you're pulling a goddamn Darth Maul. Don't do that.
You get five panels of the stalk, and then the stalk is killed. And yes. Then you're like, whoa, what? I was into that character. Like,
yeah.
What'd you do that for?
Have we not learned anything from episode one? Have we not learned anything from throwing Boba Fett down the Sarlacc pit? I'm getting so Star Wars, I need to cut that out. But then, you know, the thing about it is that makes it, it transcends that chestnut.
Yes.
Because all of the sudden it's workable. And because, I mean, the stock dies pretty early on, and then you know all bets are off. You don't know. Other than one single character, everybody else you give a flying damn about is vulnerable. You get to meet Marco's parents.
Oh, my God. That's when you realize the vulnerability.
Yes. And what a brilliant use of a character. You effectively know this character as the writer. You know you're going to kill this character in short order. And he becomes the more noble for it. Because in many ways, Barr comes in prepared to accept. Clara right. has to arrive there.
Well, Barr comes in looking for a sacrifice.
Yeah.
That's the thing that struck me about Barr, is that Barr comes in looking for a sacrifice, finds his sacrifice, saves everyone, and then leaves his wife to try to figure out how to deal with it. Which she finds a way to deal with it in the form of, and I can't even, we don't have time to get into the book. Good.
Oh,
Lord.
Well, speaking of the characters that we lose, and you know, cue the Walking
yeah.
Dead music.
I was going to say, cue the Oscars.
Oh, yeah. And I see to
in memoriam.
What a wonderful world. But yeah, you get the character of D. Oswald Heist, whose work is the catalyst. And you actually get little snippets of it here and there. The real striking point, the push outside of the nest, as it were, for our heroes is the novel Midnight Smoke.
It's a Midnight Smoke. It's so good. By D. Oswald Heist.
But it's this romance, this trashy, like, you know, dime store romance novel, you know, like in the, you just want, is it Gordon Lightfoot or who is it? It's like the kind the drugstore sell.
I mean, it might as well be if it's not.
No, yeah, damn sure better be. But that his work is, it becomes like the, there's a famous art piece known as the Fisher King.
Right.
It was produced under the noses of the Nazis, and presented as a, no, it's not religious. It's just the king of an ancient mythical land where fishing was a big part of their economy. And they're like, oh, yeah, we like that. It's like, suckers, it's Jesus, fooled your ass. You're going to be so embarrassed when you lose this war. But these trashy, god-awful novels have couched within them, hidden within them, are these genuine tale, narratives that try to speak to a hope for a better future and an end to this hostility that's meaningless, and that deep down everybody really is pretty much the same, and this is all stupid, and there you have it. Nobody gets it except Alana has the germ of getting it,
right?
And tries to get everybody. She's just so fascinated by this story, and nobody else gets it. And she doesn't even really fully understand why until she starts reading it to Marco, she's there to guard him as a prisoner.
Right.
And that becomes, and then they decide they've got to go meet him. And God, for D. Oswald Heist is brilliant. The scenes with D. Oswald Heist are brilliant. Where the board game.
Oh my God, the board game.
No, Joe Nunge or something like that, which, The design for the box of the board game is brilliant, because it's what it would look like.
Yeah.
If this alien race had a board game, and how Clara use it to trick the Marco and Alana into taking some action
It strikes me as really interesting from the beginning, right? Even from the middle of the first volume. That they take their child and they run,
yeah,
because they're being hunted by these two sides. And from about the time that it starts, you know, their initial run is the three of them plus their babysitter, ghost horror, child. That from about the time they start running, nobody understands why anyone is doing what anyone else is doing.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense to anyone. They just know they're supposed to do it. So Prince Robot has his reasons for doing it, but they don't make any sense to him. All of the mercenaries, all of the what are they? Freelancers is
freelancers,
what they call them.
Yes.
And there's brilliance in the freelancers that, again, I don't want to go too far into it, but there's brilliance in the freelancers because they have a freelance union.
Exactly, and the titles that each of them take on, the identities they each take on, it's such a brilliant kind,
yes,
of way of distinguishing their trade. And I mean, they've got the layers of brilliance in everything about this. The open circuit.
Oh my God, the open circuit.
Just, you know, trash television for the universe, and this wonderful idea that you just put this helmet on and then you're plopped into an actual audience.
Yes.
So
yes.
They're playing to you in the audience, and the way that it's illustrated, because everybody's dressed, you know, some are, you know, like they're dressed in their work clothes, some are just slumming it. It's just whatever they happen to have on when they pop in, and it shows how casual that all is, and as being sort of this entertainment option.
So who I'm going to ask you this and why, right? Because I think this is very telling. Who is your favorite character in this epic saga and why?
That is a hard one to pin down, because, for example, you fall in love with D. Oswald Heist.
Yeah, you do. Yeah,
because
you do.
You shouldn't. I mean, he's just a lech.
He's
a recluse and a bum.
The brilliant thing that they did with D. Oswald Heist is, as a writer writing D. Oswald Heist, it's the avatar of what everybody thinks a writer is. You
but
know,
it also suddenly occurred to me, like, D. Oswald Heist, Brian Kevon.
Are we
making fun of ourselves here a little bit,
the
too?
The first thing that D. Oswald Heist does, so they get off of the ship, And they fight the bone whatever, I forget what they're called.
Bone bugs.
The bone bugs that infest all the bones from the battlefield, make it whatever, it's, you'll read it, it's fine. But D. Oswald Heist comes out and kind of saves the day a little bit, and then he takes their child, because they kind of briefly explain, and he says, you know, we read A Midnight Smoke and we had to meet you. And he takes the child, and basically, you're the reason for us being here and having this child. He holds it up and looks at it, and then takes it and cradles it into his arms. And then proceeds
to point out here that he's like pissed drunk at this point.
Yeah, well, I think the general consensus is that's pretty much always the case. And just proceeds to throw up all over the baby.
Yes, exactly. And of course, Clara is just she's already on her last good nerve. And then, of course, this shit. And the other thing that's wonderful is on D. Oswald Heist's lighthouse planet.
Oh, my God.
Where he lives in a lighthouse on this planet and they ass into nowhere. The only other inhabitant of the planet.
See? That's my favorite. That was my favorite.
Is that one your favorite? Well, we'll let you introduce him. In answer to your question, I mean, there's so much to love. You know, of course, D. Oswald Heist. I loved Barr and Clara when they first arrived. You just fall in love with them. What's her name? Jenny, was it? I never knew a bat-eared purple chick.
Oh, my God, yes, yes.
Sexy. But at the end of the day, for me, hands down, I was terrified we were going to lose her. Is Lion Cat.
Oh my God. Yeah, she's been on the chopping block a few times.
Yeah, she's had a couple of close calls. She got an eye poked out, which with no explanation whatsoever, she's pretty winky in one issue, and then seems to be okay. And I was talking to Catherine one night about it. It's like, well, did she get her eye back? I said, near as we can tell.
Yeah.
But talking about a universe chock full of science and sorcery, there's plenty of ways to grow an eyeball back. So I imagine it's just left to you to figure out somewhere along the line they got a new eyeball.
Right.
Or got healed. It's okay. But Lion Cat is that wonderfully brilliant character and used to perfection. I mean, at one point there's a wonderful scene where they meet Marco's former betrothed and the Will and Lion Cat, and they're having a discussion, and Gwendolyn says something, and Lion Cat, of course, is compelled to say, lying. And she looks over at the Will and she goes, how have you not murdered this animal? And his response is beautiful. Believe me, I've tried.
Well, you want to know what's really funny? So what you just vocalized as Lion Cat's voice, that's the way I hear it.
I think that may just well be the universal.
I think it is.
It's the jagged word bubble. You have to say lying.
Well, it's the sinuous nature of the animal, like.
Well, yeah, I didn't. With subconsciously, I'm sort of invoking that guttural, like a mountain lion kind of.
Yeah.
Especially having had the personal experience of handling a young mountain lion, and when he got pissy, you'd get that.
I have a name.
Damn it.
The beauty of Lion Cat for me is.
A puma is like, you know, like a cougar.
Yeah.
Was that a puma is a younger guy.
That's right.
He's up with older guys.
So somebody called whoever it was that was explaining all this to us that one night.
I don't know what mountain lion is. I'm still trying to find that on Urban Dictionary.
But no, the beauty of Lion Cat is in the subtle use of the machination of the way that Lion Cat was written, because it's not, for me, it's not when he said, it's not when he has the wherewithal to be able to say that someone's lying, right? It's almost more interesting and more telling when he doesn't.
Exactly. And also, again, I said, you know, used to such brilliant use, because it would be very easy for Lioncat to turn into just a god-awful chestnut, to be grossly overused. Yeah. In the hands of anyone else, I think the idea of Lioncat would be like, hey, where can I plug Lioncat in next? Where can he be like the Psycor on Babylon 5 or something? Instead, you get this like when Gwendolyn's hallucinating.
Right.
And asks Lioncat, uses Lioncat as the litmus test.
Right.
And she goes, I'm looking at the woman that took my virginity. And Lioncat just get this confused, like, lying?
No.
I mean, you're telling the truth, but there's nobody there? And it literally challenges Lioncat's ability. And like you say, you know, the times when you don't see, and then other times where there's just such poignance.
Well, like the one we talked about last issue, and I posted the image to...
Oh, dear God, that is just one of the most beautiful...
So good. It's so good. I can't. I don't even want to talk about it. Just go back and listen or go read it.
Yeah. You need to experience. But Lioncat is one of the most brilliantly developed characters. And the thing is that Lioncat is given even greater strength and presence by Fiona Staples' ability to capture everything, the human form, the cat form. I mean, as somebody who grew up in a veterinary environment and has seen hundreds of thousands of cats, Fiona Staples has this insane sense of every subtle movement, every nuance of the feline form, and just the way a cat's muscles move, the way a cat looks at things, or that wonderful scene where when the Will first brings Slave Girl, he becomes Sophie on board his ship, which, again, in this brilliant kind of crazy-ass way, everything in Saga somehow makes sense. That ship is designed to look like an actual – there's an actual plant that produces a seed that looks exactly and operates that, you know, when the seed breaks free of the parent tree, I think it is some kind of tree – it actually has these little leaflets that act like a helicopter and hover it as far away from the parent tree as possible for the best possible, you know, disbursement of that particular genetic code. And there's all these little things like, you know, the dragon skull ship.
Oh, that's so cool. Yes.
It's just anything. Everything can look like whatever the hell you want. There are no rules. But, you know, when there's a scene where Lioncat's curled up around the girl, fast asleep, and it's just beautiful.
Yeah.
It just captures so much emotion. Like, damn you.
There's also one of my favorite characters that I don't think gets enough credit is Sweet Boy.
Oh, Sweet Boy.
The dog. The dead
Lioncat was bizarre.
The Deadpool dog, Sweet Boy.
Yes. Sweet Boy's the with
Saint Bernard.
Saint Bernard, yeah, with the little barrel.
It's just so weird.
With skull and crossbones on it. And apparently generates darts of various poisons and tranquilizers by firing them out of his nose at will.
It's so weird, but it's awesome. Yeah, so my favorite character, and I had to stop Cole.
N-O-C to my
is on the same planet that Oswald Heist lives. There's one, like Cole was saying, there's one other.
I had to do a David S. Punk.
You did.
Oswald Heist.
There's one other inhabitant, and his... He has a giant walrus pet named Frindo.
Oh, that's right. His little quadrupedal walrus beast of burden, Frindo.
Frindo, but his name is Goose. And Goose is a little, I guess just...
He's like a harp seal or something.
Yeah, he's like a humanoid harp seal that is absolutely, for the second half of these books...
Dear God, Goose comes, and I love when he first, who was it, who did he encounter? Was it Prince Robot?
It's Prince Robot, yeah, because they were like, traveling companions for a while. Yeah,
he's like, are you lady folk? That's always his first question. Are you lady folk?
I always imagine Goose with a Wisconsin accent.
Oh, are you lady? I like that.
Yeah, but he trades. The first thing we see Goose do is he trades. So they come through with when they end up on the planet, they stay for a while on Goose and Heist planet, the lighthouse planet. But they come and they apparently at some point trade Goose an axe. A magic axe for, I believe it's for Frindo, isn't it?
Yeah, they actually take Frindo, which becomes important later in the story.
Yeah, for sustenance sake.
Because Frindo becomes a kind of the companion, the pet for Hazel in her formative years. And later, that's how they're able to track them down, is the connection that Goose has with Frindo. And Goose is spelled with like G-U with the two dots above it.
It's an umlaut, yeah.
Yeah, and I love when they first meet, he's like, they're introducing, he's like, I'm Goose. He's like, Goose? Like G-O-O-S-E? He's like, no, Goose. It's what I said. It's like Goose knows that his name is being pronounced, in which spelling his name
is. He cuts, whose fingers does he cut off? The Will's fingers.
He cut off the Will's fingers, and I think he even cut off, didn't he? Cut Prince Robot.
But
he did slice a couple of the Will's fingers clean off.
He said, I got this chopper, I'm gonna chop you.
But also there was a wonderful scene when Marco and what's her name, Heist's ex,
Ruth,
what the hell was her name, but when they're just completely stoned on this, tainted this drug called Fade Away, which is supposed to take you back to
Yuma.
That's right. To drop you deep into your best memories. And they're just completely stoned, and Goose is trying to figure out a way to revive them, and Prince Robot's like, he doesn't care. He wants to toss him the airlock, and he's wonderful. Again, God, Fiona Staples is insanely good artist. She grabs Goose by the neck. And it's all in the way, if you've ever had a really fluffy, furry animal and you have to pick them up and you realize that somewhere under that, they're like half or less the perceived mass.
Yeah.
Because most of it's fur. He's got him around the neck and there's just this giant ruff of fur. And his neck's just tiny somewhere underneath all that. And he's like confronting him, and Goose is like, I'm not afraid of you. And he's pointing over at Marco. That one scares the life out of me.
Yeah, yes.
And he's like, we need that kind of.
Yes.
We need this ally. And they find out that they can probably make them purge all the drugs in their system by getting to ingest some robot blood because they're told that, there's this great scene where he's like, our blood is mildly toxic to organics, and Goose is there with his axe. Is that so?
Well, and the amazing thing is, in that same issue, right, Goose is somehow becomes the Greek chorus, or the honesty and the moral compass of this band of crazy drug-addled ruffians flying around in a dragon ship, because he's got Yuma all strung out on drugs, right? And she's like, she's self-doubt and self-pity, and Goose basically comes to her and says, you're not, it's not that bad. And my favorite panel is when he's like, Goose has been a lot of things in his day, but sweet was never one of them. And it's like, you're Goose, what?
How could you be anything else?
And then he's like, I've done a lot of stuff I'm not proud of, but, and then he goes on to quote Mr. Heist, which I think is a brilliant quote, which is, a fellow's more than his worst 3 days. Yeah. And I'm just like, Goose is the nicest guy in the world. Thrown in with this he's almost the R2-D2 of this book.
Oh, and yeah, that's a good analog.
Yeah, because he's just in the right place at the right time with the right mentality and the right skill set just to kind of save the day. When he so there's a scene of sacrifice with Yuma where the ship needs to be sealed because it's got a hull breach. And Goose decides that he's going to sacrifice himself to save everyone. And there's this brilliant panel of him just like, aw, shoot. And that's what he says. And he's like, I know what's going on. And he's like, I'm going to, Goose knows what Goose needs to do. And Goose is ready to go.
I know exactly what my role is in this story.
It's been a real nice trip and all, but, tell everybody Goose knows what Goose needs to do. And Goose is going to.
In the words of Roy Batty, time to die.
But it ends up Yuma sacrificing herself for the betterment of everybody realizing that that's her role. But Goose was ready to make that sacrifice. Just because he's the nicest person in the entire
exactly. Well, and the thing about it is there, every single dramatic trope occurs. Love and loss. Redemption, sacrifice, betrayal, in their own ways, both Marco and Alana flirt with betrayal.
Oh yes, very much so.
Very heavily. And I'm sorry, I'd do that Batgirl myself. She was pretty hot. I got a thing for purple women with echolocation ears.
And I mean, we didn't even get into, we do need to start wrapping this up, but we didn't get into any of her time in, any of Hazel's time in the prison school, the reveal of her wings, the praying mantis teacher.
Oh, God.
Edward James Olmos version of the praying mantis teacher.
The Last Revolution.
The Last Revolution, their Church time, group. All of their time in prison where Clara, right? The mom?
Yeah.
Did you catch this? I don't know if you caught this. It took me my second read to catch it. She shows up after being in prison and Marco finally breaks into breaks into prison to get Hazel out. And his mom's there, right?
Yeah.
Which was a shock. But his mom's covered in tattoos.
Oh, yeah. She's got, all of her prison tats.
But did you notice the one prison tat that she has is the loom?
Yes, I did see the loom.
Because the loom is what Barr used.
Yeah.
She uses it late. No, she doesn't use it later, does she? It's, what's
no,
her name?
It's, Petrichor.
Yeah. But she has a loom tattooed on her as one of her prison tattoos. Like, you see it being tattooed on her as part of... Because that was Barr's gift, was armory. Yes. And that's the way that the Wreath make armor is through magical looms. So I thought that was a really brilliant little touch.
And especially when you were introduced to Barr using the loom, and he's just like taking big fistfuls of flowers and plants from inside the rocket ship and weaving them into
clothing.
And what I loved Alana's line, she goes, "That's a loom? I thought it was a coffee press."
Yeah.
She goes, "I thought it was a coffee press. I prayed it was a coffee press."
They're so great. So many.
So it takes these incredibly alien characters and humanizes the hell out of them. And everything starts to work in a way that it shouldn't, but it does. And there was another one I loved, and this was a mind-blowing thing. I don't know how many times I'd read this before I caught on, and it is absolutely freaking brilliant. The terrorist group, the Last Revolution, who Dengo, the commoner from the Robot Kingdom, who murders the princess and steals the princeling. And I love the fact that the commoner's screens are black and white.
Yes. Yes.
That only the royals and the higher echelon have color screens. But one of the characters, Alana, who for a while was an actress in the open circuit, recognizes that one of the terrorists is dressed in the costume of an open circuit character.
Right.
And tries to engage her in conversation and explain that she used to be the character Zipless on the the open circuit. She's like, oh, there's no way you could be zipless. They, besides, there's, you know, because she was on the last episode. It's like, and Alana's all upset. And here they are being held captive by these insane terrorists. And Alana's like, they replaced me?
Yes.
And the thing about it is, that character engages one of the other of their group in a conversation about the open circuit. The other one's like, oh, I don't watch that garbage. She says, well, just as well, the season finale really sucked. It wasn't until the last reading that it occurred to me that kind of the means by which they fall into the hands of the last revolution is that Dengo comes along thinking he can use the open circuit as a bully pulpit, and they have to, you know, they're trying to explain to him it doesn't work that way. You can't just switch it on and use it anytime you want. That's not how we broadcast. And he, being a simpleton and you know, having his demands, just starts blowing everybody away. And it suddenly occurred to me, of course the season finale would suck. Half the actors were murdered.
Right.
Or kidnapped.
Oh, God.
Mind blown.
All right.
So if you've read it before and you hadn't caught that, I hope that your mind was as blown as mine when I made that conclusion.
Go read it for the first time. Read it again if you've already read it. It's one of those books you're gonna want to read every year.
Yes. If you are fortunate enough to have all the collections to hand, it will. Good Lord. Just the volume of characters you encounter. And I'm having to just, there's so much in Volume 8 that I don't want to speak of because Andy could only go so far in 7 days without having a complete mental meltdown. Good God. Volume 8 just flirted momentarily with me thinking, okay, we're losing steam here.
Okay.
There was, oh, that's clever. There's some cool stuff, as always. But I'm just thinking, yeah, we're... And then, holy crap, you told me again!
And then it brought you right back.
Good Lord Almighty.
Oh, man. All right, let's wrap this bad boy up. Here's the thing. We could do an hour on each volume of this. Easy. Oh. No questions asked.
Yeah. We could literally, do like the 12 episodes of... Amazing Comic Cast, one for each issue of Watchmen. We could do one for each volume and still not have enough time in an hour to cover the subtleties and the beauty and the story craft and the art. This is, and I think you spoke about this being Watchmen-esque, and it occurs to me, I don't think I'd fully ever articulated in my mind why. And the reason this is elevated to Watchmen, Kingdom Come, Marvels, to a lesser degree, just simply because there were so many parties involved with the art, Starman, but the titles that we hold most dear,
yeah,
it's because there is this synergy between artist and writer.
Oh, so much.
It's not this dispassionate comics the Marvel way.
Yeah.
Which I would find, you know, when you hear Stan Lee talk about it, you just, you know, have a skeletal idea. Jack would draw this stuff, then he'd write the dialogue. And I would find over the years that a lot of times that's how comics were done for so very long. And then you, like, see somebody like reprinting an image, the script for Alan Moore's clown story, and Moore has written what's happening in every single panel. That's how, when I was endeavoring to write comics, that's how I wrote, because I want what I had envisioned in my brain. And it explained to me why so often there seems to be a disconnect between the art and the story.
Right.
Because the art for so long, the conventional wisdom was the art dictated the story, or if you had a clever line in mind, the art may not match the line. And here, if somebody says something clever, the art conveys and supports that cleverness, and that is what elevates this to epic.
Oh, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly, and I don't think there's any other better way to say it other than just, go read it.
Just read the living hell out of this, because you won't regret it.
No, you won't. All right. Go ahead and plug us up. We'll get out of here. And I'm sure we're going to have another issue on
Saga.
We'll
definitely be talking
about
Saga on the Brian Cavon episode on probably our next creator spotlight. Because we really haven't done artists, writers as much as artists. So there's too much to talk about.
Yeah.
So check us out. We're here coming to you every week on the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com. You can write to us at JCUmail@gmail.com. I can't anymore
either, man.
And the good Lord, you know what we forgot?
What?
We forgot the time suck.
I know.
Leave it at you. The time suck will blow you away. But the brilliantly named time suck. And I guess we're on Instagram and the
cool spit. Can you tell? Yeah, you know, we're on the Instagram and not for nothing, but
there's some stuff for the kids and the
Angelo thing. Says hi and we're on Instagram.
Hey, we haven't heard from Angelo
in a long time. He says hello. He's got a knuckle duster sandwich for you if you want to come by and get you pick it up. He's gonna make it special for you, and he just wanted to. He wanted to let you know that he loves the show, and he wishes that you guys would sing more, and you know, so. And
special greetings from old Hollywood.
Oh, God, they're all coming back.
And the entire old
podcast. Every time a bell rings, an unfleshed out character from the Hankins Comics universe shows up.
We, all of the members of Old Cafe, highly recommend Saga.
All right. Check us out on Instagram. Check us out on Twitter. HK Comics Show. Pretty active on there. Thank you guys for sticking with us. 259 issues. We're going to be back next week with more madness. I'm not going to read Saga for about 5-6 weeks because my brain and my heart need a chance to catch up. So,
I mean, literally, I had to go and reread Arkham Asylum Living Hell as a kind of, you know, takedown to kind of get my brain thinking somewhere else. And I'm slowly, as part of the, you know, withdrawal symptoms, I'm working my way to a Jughead's Double Digest I picked up at the grocery store the other day.
All right, everybody. Say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. We'll talk to you.
The best way I think to handle this is to handle it the way that Brian Cavon, that's almost say it's Cavon. Cavon. Cavon likes his
money. Yeah, I was going to say, are we doing Levon? And Cavon was a good man.
Cavon.
Brian Cavon.
He writes a lot, they say.
Oh, nice. Nice. Cavon, my brother, he was older than me. That's getting cut into the show, by the way. That is going into the end of the show. You mark my damn words on that.
He was born